Welcome to the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. This is Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack, and in today's installment, we're going to be talking about a building that doesn't exist anymore in St. Cloud, but it's a building that helped define and protect the citizens of early St. Cloud around the college campus area in Lower Town. The name of this building is Fort Holes. It was named after the man who designed the building. It was built in 1862 out of concern about the Dakota Sioux War that was going on. And joining me today to talk about Fort Holes and the upcoming archaeological exploration of a part of the St. Cloud State University campus that's going to begin on Tuesday, September 22nd, is Dr. Rob Mann from the Anthropology Department and graduate student Charlie Poliska, who will be spearheading the project that has also been awarded a grant from the Minnesota Historical Society, which is funding the search for the remains of Fort Holes. So, gentlemen, how about we introduce yourselves and, well, what do you do here at the university?
I'm Dr. Rob Mann. I am an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology here at St. Cloud State. I'm in the anthropology program. I teach primarily in the, we have a graduate program in cultural resources management archaeology, and so I teach in that program, but I also teach undergrad classes as well.
Cool.
My name is Charlie Poliska. I'm a graduate student in the Cultural Resource Management Archaeology program with Dr. Mann.
Nice. And you've got a kind of a neat project coming up here that has been funded by the Minnesota Historical Society, a grant from that. It's Fort Holes. Why don't we just start in with that? How is this an exciting thing?
During the Dakota War of 1862, there was a panic in St. Cloud. Well, maybe not a panic, but there was concern because between the violence that was taking part in the south of the state and there was tension with the Ojibwe people to the north, people were fleeing homesteads and settlements and coming to St. Cloud. And the people of Lower Town, which is where St. Cloud State University is right now, decided to build a fortification. There was also a fortification in Upper Town, up somewhere, I imagine, kind of where the hospital is now. I don't know for sure. And then there was, kind of where Herberger's is now, there was another fortification around there. But the one on campus here, we don't really know exactly where it was, and so this is an attempt to find it.
Yeah, so the idea came about, I'm relatively new to St. Cloud State. This is my third year coming in. So I've been looking around for archaeological projects to get involved in. I'm primarily a historical archaeologist, and so I work in the periods since Europeans have arrived here in North America. And I was actually out near Fairhaven in Stearns County, and I noticed a historical marker for something called Fort Fairhaven. And I thought, wow, what is Fort Fairhaven? And it turns out it's one of these fortifications that was built during the U.S.-Dakota conflict of 1862. And digging into it a little bit deeper, I found that over 50 of these so-called settlers' forts had been built all over southern and central Minnesota as a result of the violence that was breaking out around the Minnesota River Valley. And so I thought, well, maybe we could start to look for some of these fortifications archaeologically. So this past summer, we were actually out at Fairhaven. We had another grant from the Minnesota Historical Society, and we located what we think is the palisade or stockade line for this fortification that was built in 1862 there. And in the meantime, Charlie was doing a lot of archival research into Fort Holes and wondering whether or not we could reproduce our work at Fairhaven right here on campus to see if we could locate Fort Holes. So we applied for another grant from the Minnesota Historical Society. We were very fortunate to get funding for both of these projects. And so we're at the point now of getting ready to initiate the field work in two locations that Charlie has pinpointed through his research, where we have the best opportunity to find archaeological remains of the fort.
Nice. So these forts, they weren't like U.S. military forts or anything like that. These are forts that the people who lived there created, right?
That's right. That's what makes them somewhat unique. And they also seem to have been very variable. And I'll let Charlie, since he's done most of the background research, sort of describe what Fort Holes might have looked like. It was a very unique structure.
Yeah, so why don't you do that, Charlie?
Yeah, Fort Holes had almost a medieval castle feel to it. Not that it was built out of stone. It was actually a wooden fort, but it had an outer wall that was about 100 feet in diameter, and then it had supposedly a ditch in the middle, and then it had an inner keep, so to speak, an inner fort with a big tower on the top of it with areas for sharpshooters at the top. Both the outer wall and the inner wall were constructed so that you had two walls filled with earth, and so it was very thick. It could resist gunfire, and I think they even built it so that it could possibly resist cannon fire with that much earth.
So this is a little larger than what you would think. It's like, at first I was thinking, like the stereotypical Hollywood fort, like F Troop or something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. He's got some sticks holding things back, but no, this is a little bit bigger.
Yeah, it was quite sizable. And then supposedly, according to some of the sources, it was used as a refugee camp, so to speak. We have at least two eyewitness accounts describing the fort. It was very impressive by all accounts.
Nice. So how do you go about looking for this? Is it one of those things where it's kind of like you eliminate places where it wasn't?
Well, sort of. So Charlie has done... Part of this research begins in the archives, right? And so Charlie has done a lot of sort of digging around in the old records, looking for indications of where it might have physically stood. And, of course, since the time that it was built, major changes have taken place in this part of St. Cloud. And so we are limited in some degree to areas that have not been previously disturbed by the construction of the bridge over the Mississippi, by the construction of buildings here on campus, but we have pinpointed two locations that are in the general area where we believe the fort to have stood that are also relatively undisturbed. So we'll begin there. So it's kind of a needle in the haystack, but we have to start somewhere. And this fort was so sort of structurally substantial that if anything of it survives, we should be able to pick it up.
So where are the places that you're thinking about looking then?
Well, one of them is the space in between the tennis courts and University Drive. There had been an old set of tennis courts there, and those were destroyed in, I think, 2007 or some such. And then between the child care center and university, there's that small strip of lawn, and there's a possibility that it might have been there. Kind of between where the child care center is now and Shoemaker Hall, there had been an athletic field, and there had been a written account that the fort was on the southwest corner of that athletic field. Now, whether that stood actually on the southwest corner or just southwest of it is the question.
A little ambiguous. Yeah, nice. So why do you think that they chose that particular spot?
Well, before all the construction and changes to the topography and landscape around campus, kind of where Shoemaker is and the university itself kind of sits on a nice ridge that overlooks the Mississippi, and kind of where the boat landing is now, down by where the parking is for the Hallenbeck Hall and all that, that was at that point even a boat landing. And the fort was there to make sure that stayed safe. And it was a nice kind of central open area in Lower Town.
Nice.
And because it had sort of a tower to it, it would have had command over the Mississippi River. That is, you could have seen who was coming and going. And, of course, that's what they were mostly interested in, was kind of watching to see what was coming their way. And so it would have given them sort of command of the river. And, of course, that's a strategic place to be if you're looking for folks coming your way.
Well, how did this fort and these other forts, how did that kind of define where people lived or how St. Cloud developed? How do you think that kind of tied into each other?
Well, this was such a sort of short-lived event. So the fort was built in 1862. It was probably gone by 1865, maybe even before that. As tensions sort of died down, the forts became sort of unnecessary. And it seems to be the case, I think, for Fort Holes in particular, but probably for others as well, that all of a sudden people are looking around and saying, wow, there's a lot of timber there, and we don't really need a fort there anymore, but we could build a church, or we could build this. And so I think for the most part, once the tensions sort of died down, people didn't really look to the fort as sort of a place of safety or anything. They were now sort of looking around to expanding. And the forts sort of all came down probably within 2, maybe 3 years of their construction. So they weren't permanent in any real sense, which also makes them very intriguing archaeologically. There are no extant examples of any of these 50 settlers' forts that I'm aware of. There are a couple of reconstructions that have been done, one at Forest City, for example, that I've visited. But it's as you suggested, it kind of looks like Fort Laramie, right? It's somebody's imagination of what a frontier fort should look like rather than based on any real sort of archaeological data that might suggest exactly what that fortification looked like. So that's one of the things that we're really interested in is how can archaeology contribute to our knowledge of these forts that no longer exist? Even as far as I'm aware, there are no photographs of any of these forts, though of course photography was well in use by the 1860s. We've all seen the Civil War photographs, for example. Mm-hmm. But no picture of Fort Holes that we know of, no picture of Fort Fairhaven, for example, that we know of. And so what we know about them is what little was written about them, and Fort Holes was written about more than many of the others. And the rest of what we can know about them is still buried in the ground, and that's where archaeology comes in.
Nice. And what are you hoping to find? How would you be able to tell that there was a fort there?
Well, the main thing we're going to be looking for are curved features. There were, after the fort was torn down, there were two houses that were built there. The earliest I have records for that, those houses, are about 1920. And then when the university bought the land in the late 50s to early 60s, the houses were torn down. So both those houses were very rectangular with nice, you know, right angles and everything. Mm-hmm. But if I can find, or if we can find, circular markers where the walls had stood, I'm particularly interested to see if I can find where the gates were. There were supposedly two gates to the outer wall. Maybe those gates could tell us where they were most interested in either retreating to or charging out of, or where they would have been coming from. Do they face 10th Street, what is now a university? Do they face the river? I don't know. It's also going to be interesting to see if we can find evidence of daily life, if refugees actually did stay in there. There were soldiers who were on their way to North Dakota to Fort Abercrombie that had camped outside the fort. Maybe we can pick up evidence of their campsites.
So we'll be looking for a couple of signatures. One of the things that, as archaeologists, we look for are changes in the soil color and texture. So we don't anticipate that we will dig down and find, aha, the foundations of the fort. What we're more likely to find are stains in the soil that represent where the fort once stood. When you dig a hole in the ground, it never gets filled back in exactly as it was when you dug it out, and that creates a change in the soil color, texture, etc. Those changes remain pretty stable over time. So even 150 years ago, and even longer, right, we can find remains of disturbances, like when people dug a pit to build a fire in, for example, that changes the texture, color, and sort of characteristics of the soil. So it's very subtle sometimes, but that's what we'll be looking for. So for example, at Fairhaven, we found places buried in the ground where we believe post once stood for the stockade. So when a post rots away, it leaves a stain in the ground, a very characteristic sort of stain. So we'll be looking for very subtle sort of soil stains. It's not maybe as romantic as some people might imagine archaeology being. We're not going to dig up entire, you know, foundations or anything like that of this fort. We're going to be looking for subtle clues in the soil that indicate that something was here. And as Charlie said, we'll be looking for the shape and size of those clues. And if they match what we know the shape and size of the fort to be, then we can start to say, aha, we think that we have evidence for the remains of the fort. Now, of course, archaeologists also look for artifacts, and we will be doing that. And there might be some artifacts associated with the construction of the fort. If you think about what kinds of things might have been needed, like nails and spikes, hinges, potentially, those kinds of things. And they may have been left behind as well. And they tend to last in the ground fairly long periods of time. Wrought nails and cut nails, machine cut nails and those sorts of things do last in the ground under certain conditions. So we'll be looking for those. As Charlie suggested, the fort was never occupied by the military, as far as we know, but it does seem to have housed some refugees from other communities who abandoned their communities and came to St. Cloud because their safety in numbers, basically, right? And they didn't have necessarily places to put them up, and so they put them in the fort. Now, those people might have left behind some material culture, broken dishes, lost buttons, those kinds of things. We'll be screening the soil as we excavate, looking for that kind of evidence as well.
Yeah, just little clues left over. You know, those things that, you know, we don't even think about it. You lose a button. Well, yeah, you put a new button on your thing. You don't think about it. Well, that button's somewhere.
That's right. And some archaeologists will find it one of these days.
Uh-huh. And then they'll know what kind of pants you wear.
That's right.
You're in tune to 88.1 FM KVSC and the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. Today we're talking with Dr. Rob Mann and Charlie Poliska from the St. Cloud State University Anthropology Department about an archaeological search for the remains of Fort Holes from the U.S. Dakota War era that's on the St. Cloud State University campus. The search, which is also funded by the Minnesota Historical Society, begins on Tuesday, September 22nd. And as we get back into it, Dr. Mann tells us about how they go about looking for something that's no longer there, nor has been, for over 100 years.
That's neat, though, just thinking about, you know, how you tell the difference, you know, the difference in the soil. You know, I was thinking about it like a construction site. You know, you've got your foundation for a house, and it's this, it's concrete, it's, you know, cinder block or something, and that's going to sit there for a while. But even that, you know, after a long time, you know, the house burns down or is torn down, and then there's this, you know, the weeds come up and, you know, the house gets kind of reclaimed, but then there's this thing left over.
That's right.
And that's, you know, within, you know, 20, 30, 100 years or something like that. But yeah, this is a different type of thing. You're not looking for necessarily, well, it is a concrete thing that you're looking for, but it's not concrete. So it's kind of tricky use of language there. It's like this echo of the past that you're looking for, and it's not so just right out in front of you. Or it's rarely like that. I imagine you run into that every once in a while.
Occasionally we do, right? There's something called the Pompeii effect, right? If something gets covered over very quickly and people don't have a chance to abandon it, then you might find that. In this case, you know, we don't anticipate finding wood, for example. The wood will have rotted away. But when wood rots away, it leaves a stain. And so those stains then become the key components for us, right? Those are the markers that we're looking for. Like I said, they're a little more subtle, maybe a little less romantic than people might have in mind, but for us, nevertheless, meaningful. And if we can find them, hopefully we'll be able to sort of reconstruct where the fort would have stood, what it might have looked like, and how that aligns with those historic accounts that described it.
Well, and then also, you know, kind of along these lines, I guess, this isn't the first project that's happened around campus. Can you tell us a little bit about some of those that have gone on over the years? Because I remember, I've been around here about 12 years or so, and I remember, you know, every once in a while, it's like there's a... There's a feel, you know, there's a little part of campus, and all of a sudden there's a bunch of students, and they're digging stuff up.
That's right. So Dr. Deborah Gold is an archaeologist in our department as well, in the anthropology program. And she, over the course of several field seasons, has conducted archaeological excavations outside of Shoemaker Hall. As Charlie indicated, that previously was a part of Lower Town. So there were people that were living there, houses that had been built there. And the remains of those people's houses and lives is sort of buried in the grounds around Shoemaker Hall. And so Dr. Gold led several investigations in that part of campus looking for evidence for Lower Town.
It's a neat little mystery, I guess, you know. It's kind of a tangent, but not really. I do a Mississippi River cleanup with a bunch of friends every year. And the stuff that we find along the river, you know, there's a place just on the east side, just right around or just south of the Highway 23 bridge. We're thinking that that possibly at one point was a landfill or something. People were just dumping stuff down the hill.
Right.
Because we always find like just porcelain.
Right.
And it's just like, well, how did this get here?
Things start to erode out of the riverbanks. Absolutely. Yeah, we see that a lot.
Yeah. It's pretty. So there's been folks around here.
They've been here and they leave behind stuff. Yeah. That's the good part for us.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Some of that stuff is weird. So you've got the, why don't you tell us about this current dig once again. When and where is it happening again? Because it's starting up here pretty soon.
Well, on Tuesday, we're going to have an alumni. Megan Stroh is going to be here with a machine called the gradiometer. It measures magnetic variations in the Earth. It's kind of equivalent to kind of X-ray in the ground in a way, in that it shows us variations in the magnetic field, which would show us potentially buried features without having to actually move soil yet. After we get done with that and we get the results of that survey, we can then plan on where we would like to excavate so that we are targeting areas instead of putting in a grid of shovel tasks all over the site.
Nice. So if somebody were interested in, you know, watching this or getting involved with it, how would they go about doing that?
Well, so for Tuesday, we are inviting the campus out to come and see us. There won't be opportunities to volunteer necessarily because it's pretty much a non-destructive process. And so Megan will use her instrument to sort of walk over the grounds where we anticipate we might have the likelihood of finding archaeological remains. But it's a very interesting process to watch her work and to sort of see the results of that. She can download the data onto a laptop, and we can kind of look to see where geophysical scientists call anomalies, right? They don't know what those anomalies represent. They just know that their machine is telling them that something different is going on here, right? It could be that 50 years ago a tree fell over here or some other natural phenomenon. It could be that 150 years ago somebody built a fort here. So the next step in the process after we do this geophysical survey is to do what archaeologists call ground truthing. So these non-destructive technologies that we have for sort of x-raying the ground, as Charlie said, peering below the surface without digging, they give us a sense of where things might be. And then as archaeologists, we still have to go back and excavate. So when we get to that step in the process, Charlie will be looking for folks who might be interested in volunteering, and we may have a volunteer program set up through Stern's History Museum. And so people might be able to get involved that way. We would also encourage people, even if they don't want to come out and get their hands dirty, to still come out and see what we're doing. And each day that we're out there, we'll make sure that if people come by with questions that we'll stop and answer any questions that they might have. If we have anything to show them, we'd be happy to show them. We really want to open this up and make it sort of a public archaeology event. Oftentimes archaeologists do their work sort of behind the scenes and nobody really knows what's going on. We want to sort of demystify, as Dr. Gold did for many years at Shoemaker, we want to demystify sort of the archaeological process and invite people to come and watch us work.
Nice. Yeah, it is. It is an interesting process, yeah. So what kind of timeline do you have for maybe a finished product, if you will, or can you even put those kind of terms to it?
Well, we're figuring the actual excavation where the public can come out would be probably early to mid-October, and then analysis of the artifacts or whatever is recovered probably would be finished by maybe end of winter. I'm hoping to complete a thesis on this and graduate in May. Yeah, so
there's a timeline.
Yeah. A very important timeline.
I'm hoping that we can have at least a preliminary result by the end of the school year. And then the hope is that if we are successful in finding this, other students in the future can then go further with this project.
Right. So we see this as maybe the first stage in a longer term project, if in fact we do find remains that indicate we've located the fort. The other part of the timeline issue is that we do have a year under the terms of our grant with the Minnesota Historical Society. So Charlie will be writing his thesis, but we will also prepare a report and submit that to the Minnesota Historical Society. We hope to also do things like go out to the community and present the results of our excavations, like places like Stearns History Museum. In October, St. Cloud State is co-sponsoring, co-hosting an archaeological conference, the Midwest Historical Archaeology Conference, down at the Mill Cities Museum. And we will be presenting at least some of the preliminary findings there over the course of that conference. So there will be other times and places where we hope to engage the public as well. But we probably have, sort of a year is our time frame to wrap all of this up.
Excellent. 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 In wrapping up, why is digging up history? Why is all this important?
Well, so we as archaeologists, we understand that in especially in historical times that there's a lot that has been written, but not everything was written down. And the other aspect of this that's really intriguing for me as a historical archaeologist is that what was written down was usually written down from a certain perspective. And that perspective doesn't cover everybody who lived at any one place at any one time. However, the archaeological record is more democratic. Everybody left behind trash. And they oftentimes didn't think much about where they deposited their trash. And so there's not a whole lot of bias that went into those kinds of processes. So the archaeological record can tell us a lot about daily lives of people who might not have been written about much, who might not show up in the history books all that often. And so we find it a way to construct what we sometimes refer to as like alternative historical narratives, right? We can write about things that historians might not necessarily have access to the same kinds of information, like those lost buttons, for example, that can tell us something about clothing styles or about the kinds of people who are at a particular place at a particular time, who may not have written much about their experiences, but nevertheless were there and left behind traces of their experiences.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those, you get more of a picture instead of a written account. Yeah,
that's right. We'd love to try and paint a picture, and oftentimes we're able to do that because archaeology is such a visual science. We will find things in the ground that we can photograph. We will find artifacts that we can measure and describe and photograph, and it's also a tangible sort of connection to the past that I think is also important.
Absolutely. Well, thank you both for coming in here today for the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota, and good luck on your dig.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And once again, we've been talking with Dr. Rob Mann and Charlie Poliska about the upcoming archaeological exploration on the St. Cloud State University campus. It begins on Tuesday, September 22nd, over by the Child Care Center. Stay tuned to 88.1 FM KVSC and the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota as we check back on this story as the process develops. Also be able to find information on the Stearns History Museum website and the Minnesota Historical Society website, all linkable from our website at kvsc.org. This has been Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack, and the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota is made possible through funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. It has been produced at KVSC, a proud member of AMPRS, Diverse Radio for Minnesota's communities.